Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yemi's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that.
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to The Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat. Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.
From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today's Tuesday, August 17th.
If someone's overdosing or is having a substance abuse issue, why is that a badge and a gun situation? If someone doesn't have a place to sleep, why a badge and a gun? That's solving a problem with your electrical wiring in your house with a hammer.
That's Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, co-founder and CEO of the Center for Policing Equity, on the issues of police reform and what cities can do to ensure that they're appropriately responding to the needs of their communities. We're going to dig into that a little later on, but first, your morning headlines.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces.
That was President Joe Biden yesterday defending his actions in Afghanistan after the Taliban's takeover of the capital. Evacuations of the U.S. Embassy staff and military forces from Kabul airport were briefly halted on Monday as crowds of Afghans rushed onto the airfield. Those evacuations have now resumed. The fate of U.S. allies, specifically the Afghans who worked as translators for U.S. and NATO forces and their families, remains uncertain. Large crowds of Afghans rushed to the airport in Kabul throughout the day on Monday to escape the violence. Shocking video showing citizens clinging to a moving plane as it taxied the runway circulated widely on social media. Several of those people died. U.S. forces have reportedly also shot and killed two armed men. Al Jazeera is reporting that the Taliban have now blocked access to the airport, firing warning shots to keep people away from the area. U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer says remaining forces will focus on keeping the airport secure. An additional 1,000 troops were currently scheduled to arrive last night or early this morning. Turning now to COVID, concerning news for parents with babies and toddlers at home. A new report from the Canadian Public Health Agency revealed that while babies and toddlers are less likely to bring COVID into the household, they are more likely to become super spreaders in the home if infected. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that all healthcare workers in the state, including those at hospitals and nursing homes and adult care workers, must get at least one dose of the vaccine by September 27th. To date, 75% of all New York healthcare workers are fully vaccinated, while only 68% of nursing home workers are. Today will mark the first day that New York City's Key to NYC program will be in effect. The program mandates vaccinations for people to be allowed into many indoor venues, including restaurants, gyms, and now also museums. The vaccination requirement becomes enforceable on September 13th. The federal government announced on Monday for the first time in history a water shortage in Lake Mead. That's one of Colorado River's main reservoirs. A long-term drought coupled with climate change is being blamed. The declaration means mandatory cuts in the water supply, mostly affecting Arizona farmers, at the beginning of next year. Much smaller reductions have been issued for Nevada and Mexico, both of whom rely on the Colorado River to supply their reservoirs. And now to our daily deep dive. In the wake of George Floyd's killing at the hands of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin last year,
The nation saw a groundswell of support for enacting meaningful police reform. What kinds of changes can we make to lessen the likelihood that a George Floyd-like incident ever happens again? Dr. Philip Atiba-Goff is a Yale professor and co-founder and CEO of the Center for Policing Equity. It's a nonprofit with the mission of figuring out how to make policing less deadly, racist, and omnipresent. Dr. Goff, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
What do you say to people who say, is it really possible to make a police force less racist?
I say yes. So there are folks who believe that because the origins of policing largely in the United States are rooted in slavery, slave patrols, and the enforcement of Jim and Jane Crow, literally the policing of Black people and Black bodies, Native people and Native bodies, it's impossible to have a police force that's not racist. And to that I say, maybe. But the question is, can you make them less racist? And yes, institutionally and situationally. You can select folks. You can, in fact, though it's a weak lever for change, you can train folks to engage in behavior that is less racially disparate. You can create policies that produce less racial disparity. So you can reduce the harms of the systems we've got, even as we're reimagining and redesigning for systems we don't yet have, but that we're going to need to completely uproot what we've been doing that's been wrong and replace it with something better.
You know, your mission, you say, is to figure out the how to make policing less deadly, racist, omnipresent. How do you go about figuring out the how?
There are three levels that it's useful to look at when we're talking about public safety, when we're talking about most problems. One is sort of the immediate situational level. How do we prevent an officer who's shown up from unnecessarily unholstering a weapon? That's actually the level that we've been talking about for a long time, because it's hard to imagine how we prevent the officer from showing up in the first place, right? There's also the institutional level. What policies do we put in place so that the officer doesn't show up unnecessarily, so that in general, the culture of the organization responds more appropriately, more consistent with the values of the residents, the community that they're serving? But we also have to look structurally. The things that are outside of the police department, right? The things that are framing our whole orientation to crime, to deprivation, to poverty. But for each of them, what we do is we work backwards from the solution we're trying to get to. So if what we're trying to do is to say, all right, so we've got police, how do we make sure that when they show up, they're beating people up less, that they're arresting people less, they're using less force? Literally what we do is we optimize towards that outcome. We first got to measure it. We work backwards from it. We look for the places where force is least associated with actual violence endangering community and where force is racially disparate at the highest. And we say, hey, what are you doing over here? Because it looks like there's a lot of people getting beat up and they are mostly Black and brown. You maybe cut that out. It's not more complicated than that. But I really think in this moment, we have the opportunity to look at structural things. And I can tell you the things that work are communities having the resources not to call out in crisis in the first place. Literally, it's cash, it's jobs, it's educational systems that feed into the ability to make determinations for themselves. It's access, it's resources to mental health, to homeless facilities, to eviction moratoriums. Those are things that prevent the need for law enforcement, and they also replace what we're using law enforcement to do inappropriately. Those structural fixes are the places I want us to be going as we're going forward, because those are the ones that are the biggest levers for change. And we finally have a discourse that allows those to be mainstreamed.
Mental health is such an important angle right now. The Chicago police superintendent said that officers responded to 41,000 mental health calls in 2019. I mean, that was just before the pandemic even was in full force. How do you balance what so many of these calls aren't necessarily violent, but they touch on mental health issues that also need to be addressed?
So if someone has a mental health crisis, why on earth are we sending a badge and a gun to respond to that? By the way, if someone's overdosing or is having a substance abuse issue, why is that a badge and a gun situation? If someone doesn't have a place to sleep, why a badge and a gun? That's solving a problem with your electrical wiring in your house with a hammer. Why would you want to do that? It's not going to help that person. It's not going to prevent the next thing. And we're all going to end up paying, not just for the overtime of law enforcement, but for locking that person up, for getting that person treatment while they're there, and for dealing with the traumas they just had from the way we tried to solve the situation.
So how do you counter that with policing?
You don't. You don't send police when someone is in a mental health crisis. So in Denver, the STAR program, right, which was essentially sending mental health responders when there's a crisis and not police. By the way, if they show up, the person is violent, they can call police because that's what you call police for, is for violence. But the vast majority of calls, no police were called. person was calmed down, was given the services that they requested and that someone needed, and lives were saved. The chief said, it is unconscionable that it took us this long to start doing it. And by the way, calls to 911 in cities like Denver that are trying this out, they double and triple and quadruple, which means people aren't calling 911 when they're in mental crisis because they don't want the cops to come. We have a hugely untreated population, unserviced population in mental health crisis all the time because we don't have a way for them to cry out for help and have an unarmed response to them.
Mm. You know, Washington State also passed what's easily the country's most ambitious police reform legislation. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And do you think other states should follow?
In Washington state, what we're seeing is the culmination of what's happening in lots of states. What they're saying is essentially trying to encourage folks. We're not going to send armed responses to unarmed crises. We're going to make sure that there are better resources for folks who are homeless. I think that what's happening on the state level is really important, but maybe more important than what's happening in Washington state or New York state or even in Colorado are states that are saying we're not going to preempt local change. Here's what I mean. State preemption is a very unsexy phenomenon. It's not a thing that we talk about very often because it seems highly technical, but it's where a state passes a law that says local municipalities can't do a thing. So when a state passes a law that says you may not abolish your police department, you may not disband a police department, it literally means no city in the state can do that. And what we're seeing is incrementally state after state passing state preemption on these kinds of crisis interventions. So states looking at laws to say, you know what, we're not going to replace our law enforcement with mental health workers. Why? That's the thing where states are saying, no, we're not going to have state preemption. We're going to allow localities to innovate and to try to experiment in ways that are keeping folks safe, but trying new things so that we don't end up with these tragedies. That, I think, is going to be a really important element as we move forward, in part because what's happening right now nationally is the pendulum swinging against these kinds of changes. And so I want to make sure that we've got states and localities that are loaded for bear as we start seeing a conservative push back against these really righteous changes in local communities.
We've got to take a short break. We're going to be back with Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, co-founder and CEO of the Center for Policing Equity.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Hey, it's Zuko and Kayla from The Wake Up Call. Enjoy your podcast, but when you're done, don't forget about us. We have a radio show. We try to bring a smile to your face every morning.
We also talk to some of the hottest country stars of today, and we like to share some good news with That's What I Like.
Because Lord knows that's hard to find. When you're done podcasting your podcast, listen to us at 92.3 WCOL.
Set your preset on your radio right now, and don't forget you can listen to us online on the iHeartRadio app.
Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. We're here with Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, Yale professor and co-founder and CEO of Center for Policing Equity. The George Floyd death was such a big eye-opening moment for our country. What do you think has changed in the past year and a half since the wake of George Floyd's case? Is there any reason to be optimistic?
Well, there's always reason to be optimistic because we have the day in front of us. We see all of these experiments happening all over the country trying to make this better. The opportunity to say, hey, this whole system is jacked up. We should do something different. But there are a couple of things that really have changed in the last year that I think are worth pointing to. The first is that the notion of abolition has moved from a popular one within decarceration reforms to also policing and public safety. And that has allowed for us to not talk about policing and criminal justice, but the criminal legal system writ large. They're all together and some of the themes are moving. They've been mainstreamed to our national consciousness. We've all heard defund. Some of us are hearing the word abolition. All of that is good. The other piece is that there's significantly more money flowing to local organizers and activists. In 2017, about 2.5% of all the philanthropic dollars that went to criminal legal advocacy went to policing and public safety. Last year, my estimates are about a third did, right? So that's good. That's better. And the folks who are in this space advocating locally and are starting to create a national movement and coalition, they're getting the national attention. They're getting the ears of policymakers and funders. And largely, there's lots of good that comes from that. I hope that in terms of a policy thing, the one thing we don't go backwards on, we're starting to say less, please. Less of this system that is designed for punishment and not treatment or cure.
You know, it just seemed like for some time there was Black Lives Matter and then there was Blue Lives Matter, and the two should never intersect. How do you rebuild that level of trust in a community that doesn't necessarily have that trust for people who wear the badge?
It's a good question, and it's a harder one to answer than it's ever been before, in part because I think it's important to note there are lots of organizers that aren't interested in rebuilding that trust. There are folks who feel that the trust as a metric for communities with law enforcement is trust in a system that has to brutalize and oppress you. The construction of state systems, ways we live together that are consistent with the values of communities, that serve communities the way they want to be served, those systems will have earned the trust of communities. And whether we call that policing or we call it something different, like in Ithaca, now they're moving to call it a Department of Community Solutions and Public Safety, no more just Department of Policing. I think that's the way forward. I think that in many of these communities, the relationship is so toxic, we're going to need something different before there's the opportunity to earn folks' trust. We're going to need to dismantle some of the things we've given to law enforcement, give those resources back to communities, and see where we are on the other side.
Dr. Goff, if the White House came to you and said, we want a national policy that'll transform policing in America, what would you say to President Biden?
I'd say the idea for that national policy has been around for a long time, and I wish that we would take it seriously. And the idea is reparations.
So you believe reparations is the solution?
I think reparations is the biggest possible lever that a person could pull to bring this country out of the unpaid debt it's owed to Black communities for 400 plus years. When we're talking about public safety, going towards reparations can feel like it's a record scratch, because people imagine the problem with public safety are the systems that we've got, as opposed to the reasons we chose to put them in place in the first place. If anybody has driven around suburbs, you might be scared. If you're not from the suburbs, or if you look like you don't belong there, you might be scared that law enforcement is going to pull you over, do bad things to you. Folks that live there aren't scared, because if they're having a mental health crisis, they have hospitals, doctors, free clinics they can go to. If they're out of work, they have job training facilities. Their schools prepare them for a life where they can determine what kinds of vacations they go on, where how they're going to treat their kids. It's the places that don't have those things where you end up making bad choices, again, when all you have are terrible options. And it's those places where we've chosen instead to stand up the opportunities to do something different. We've chosen to punish people for the choices they make within those systems. The idea of reparations is first a moral obligation to say, we did wrong, we should right that. But it's also, let's provide something better than terrible options in the communities where that's not so much the case. Until we've looked that square in the face, it'll look like, oh, well, they had a knife, they had drugs, their pants were sagged. We can find a way to justify what a group of folks sent out with the authority to punish are gonna do. I want us to think instead about how we prevent that situation from happening in the first place. And if we're not thinking about the path people took to the choices we end up punishing them for, we're never gonna get out of this. And we're gonna see cities burn every few years, like clockwork. And so as a country that has gone through such incredible gut-wrenching economic and emotional and spiritual crisis of this past year, we absolutely can find the money to make good on the terrible sins of chattel slavery that we've made in this country. My strong feeling is that that's the level we've got to be thinking on if we want to pull the biggest lever to get us out of where we are right now.
You know, I think it's the issue of reparations. It's so divisive, and people feel if you start paying now, where does it end? Right?
I get it.
You laugh, but you know, I just feel like a lot of people, it's so politically charged, and people are like, what else do we go back and pay for? Right?
I'm trying to frame it in a way that isn't just wonky. And to put it in reparations term, I'm like, so if I kick somebody in the head and I pay their medical bills, where does it end? When I've caused an injury, I want to be accountable. I want to make sure that I make it right. There are injuries, material injuries, in terms of generational economic deprivation in this country that are directly attributable to slavery, to Jim and Jane Crow, to government redlining. All of those things are truly evil things that we did in this country to promote the wealth of some by exploiting and extracting labor from others. It's not complicated. It's not a morally fraught issue. But somehow paying for the fact that we as a country, some of us, have benefited from that exploited labor, that's controversial. And I wonder how far we need to go to recognize how morally bankrupt that position is. If I have to be accountable for the terrible things I've done that have generational consequences, where does it end? I don't know when you've finished being accountable for it. That'd be my strong guess. So these questions of accountability for one of the original sins of this country need to be at the forefront because, like any broken relationship, if you fail to deal with the questions that are corroding the relationship will fall apart. We did that once in this country. It led to war. I sure as heck hope we're not close to that now. But I would like for us to deal directly and look honestly at our history so we can stop telling lies about who we are.
Dr. Goff, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. European Union foreign ministers will hold a crisis meeting today to discuss the chaotic situation in Afghanistan and how they can safely evacuate their citizens and local staff. They will also visit what recent developments may mean for Europe's security and what could become a surge in migration to the continent. Clinical psychologist Mary Trump, former President Trump's niece, has a new book hitting shelves today. The Reckoning, America's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal, explores the psychological pain inflicted by the nation's long history of slavery and racial injustice. The book also looks at things we can all do to help heal that trauma. And how's this for a throwback? 23 years ago today, President Bill Clinton admitted in a television address to the nation that yes, he did indeed have sexual relations with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. He had initially denied it.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
Clinton went on to be impeached by the House of Representatives, but was ultimately acquitted in the Senate. Have a great day, everyone. I'll see you back tomorrow. This is the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Dr. Philip Atiba Goff for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to the Recount Daily Pod and leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.
Check the back seat. Check the back seat.
All right, come here.
Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the back seat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.